Hi, welcome to the Beit Midrash, take two.
Welcome to Talmud class.
No, I was just saying quickly that we left off on page 5 of Tani, and the last little piece of Gemara we saw, we were in the middle of Rabbi Natan brought Limudim, brought different pieces that Rabbi Yochanan had helped us learn out. And there was going to be a series of those, and we asked whether or not they were really related to the Tani material we were learning with the kind of approach to Talmudic editing. We were debating whether or not, since they were learnings in Rabbi Natan's name, when he brought Rabbi Yochanan to explain a certain verse and what it means, there was the possibility that it simply was just a collection of all those stories, like a little anthology of Rabbi Natan asked, what does this mean? Or Rabbi Natan brought Rabbi Yochanan to say, hey, what is this verse really talking about? But we were also thinking about it in terms of some of the narrative material of Tanit so far, pages 2, 3, 4. And the last little piece we were learning was a piece where he was explaining what a verse meant when it talked about Hevel. And instead of Hevel being in vain, he interpreted Hevel, Hevelim, as in the Ecclesiastes version of all is in vain, as in all is idol worship, or potentially idol worship. And we were talking about rereading Ecclesiastes with this notion that the word Hevel actually means Avodah Zarah, according to Rabbi Yochanan's explanation. That got me thinking, along with the notion that sinners who do idol worship go to Gehenna, go to the darkest place that you experience once your soul is sullied with sin, and you, in the afterlife, don't get Olam Haba right away. At least according to the Zohar, you kind of have the way station of Gehenna, and backwards in time, the Tanakh has a kind of sense that you will spend some time in the valley of darkness if you are a sinner in life, and whatever that means back in the Tanakh time versus a mystical interpretation of it in medieval ages we won't go into just yet. But down the line, we're going to study about that issue as we've been studying about all the different rabbinic concepts that come up throughout the Tani, Masechet Tani. I thought, oh, how appropriate for Hanukkah time. Because the Greeks, who started to create a more, let's say, tyrannical version of the humanism that they felt they should spread, meaning it was just tyranny, it wasn't humanism at all, but as they thought about it, the Seleucids, who were the post-Alexander the Great emperors of Syria, or Hellenized Syria, they tried to really jam down the throats of the Jews and of all others the kind of hegemonic rule that defined a tyrant, right? And Antiochus himself, who becomes the king, calls himself what? You know, quite humbly, Epiphanes.
What?
Epiphanes. Meaning, I am the Lord. Right? I am God. So, a little bit of a self-centered, you know, pray to me, let me bring a statue of myself into your precinct. Let me bring also the statue of Zeus. And idol worship becomes somewhat of the central feature of the story in the way that we have to understand the real military history. And then those who are assimilationists who say it might not be so bad if we offer a few, let's say, tributes to the emperor and to their gods. That creates the internal strife, right, with Matityahu, HaChashmonai, with Mattathias, who is from the Chashmonai family, and he's going to lead the band of his sons, one of whom is Judah, who is known as Hamachabi, the hammer, and his other sons, right, you have Yochanan, and you have Yonatan, and you have Eleazar, and you have Shimon. And you have this band who's going to come together, and they're going to create the first, if you will, guerrilla war against a colonizing or a hegemonic tyrannical power. And this is the background. And a lot of it is about the dark times that we descend to when we assimilate towards what could be, not just in vain, but what could be idol worship. That's the background of Hanukkah. And that kind of theme led me to think that tonight, since it's in the Gemara, and Hanukkah made it into the Gemara, and it's not in the Torah, right? That's what we famously say about Hanukkah, not in the Torah. That's really rabbinic cultural production that creates Hanukkah. I wanted to show you inside where Hanukkah comes from, since it's Hanukkah time, in the Gemara. There's a link back to our overarching narrative of Tani. And that is, like with many, many Masechtot in the Gemara, the respect that has already come through for temple culture and temple avodah, the worship in the temple, is readily apparent in the first several dapim of our Masechta, which is Tani. Right? There's also the rabbi's pride of place in terms of their study of Torah and their becoming the Talmidei Chachamim, and a young scholar burns with the fire and he's fertile like the fields who need rain and precipitation, getting us back to the natural world of Tanit and everything it's been about, right? But the respect for temple culture that is in the pages we've already studied for sure is expressed in the piece or pieces of Gemara that I'm going to show you about Hanukkah tonight as well. And their location also interests us tonight, which is, why are we going to see Hanukkah located in Masechet Shabbat? There's going to be a simple level answer, and then there's going to be a deeper message that I think you can see in parallel to the notions we've been discussing about the temple, its place, the rabbinic culture, and the anti-either idolatry or other cultures that are possible when it comes to worship, recognizing God's power. Remember, we went through the whole us versus Greek philosophy of noting the powers of God versus all the elements and their role in being powers of the world, having creative force, having powers of life and death, and that we undermined that or we upended that in rabbinic culture in Tani by saying, no, God controls both fire and water. God controls weather, rain, dryness and heat, desert and fertile plain. So that's really where we are, and I want to put Hanukkah then into that greater context tonight to explore in more depth one of the themes that's come out of Tani, but in and of itself, it's just fun to sit around the Beit Midrash as well to say, hey, let's deepen this Hanukkah experience. Because I'll open with this question, without being on a page of Gemara, given all that hakdama, that precy. What do you think the adult version, if you will, or the adult gleanings, the mature student of Torah gleanings are when it comes to the story of the oil, the miracle of the oil? What's the next level? Yeah. If there wasn't enough, whether you think the miracle and there's machloket, was the first day really a miracle, or did they light the oil, figuring it was first day and then 7 days a miracle versus eight? That's one halachic kind of, or Jewish thought level, playful kind of way into this miracle. But now take that miracle that you all have heard for sure. It burned 8 days. Right? What's the message on a very different level, on a mature student of Torah level? Let's produce that together. You may not have the full answer. I don't have the full answer. We're going to produce that answer without text for a minute. What's the adult level? Jay, start us off.
Say this only because I don't remember what I was reading, but I recently saw something. I don't know if it was at Torah.com or someplace else. But it was an article about the stress that was placed at the time on the purity of oil. The philosophy of the oil did not need to be pure, but that was so crucial to them at the time, I think, even on the simplest level, psychologically, because they were coming from a point of the temple having been so defiled, that it was important for them that the oil be very pure. And it just made me wonder for the first time ever about, is the quality of the oil have anything to do with the duration of the strength with which it burns? And then you could just carry that through symbolically in terms of what's important to us. I don't know if that makes any sense, because they said they found a quantity of oil that should only last one day. I don't know if they were factoring into that what was the quality of the oil. But anyway, I'm just throwing that out as a place to start, because I'd never even thought about it in that way before. I so accepted the story on the surface, because for so many years what's been important to me was the political reality of the holiday and that aspect of the miracle, the fact that we won militarily. And focus as much on
the oil. Great. So keep in mind this question of purity of the oil. Yeah, Dale.
I've also never thought about the question you posed, but I go back to what's important about the holiday is the rejection of and defeat of Greek culture versus what you just called temple culture, and the oil lasting may be a symbol of everlasting Judaism, service to the one God.
Yeah. Remind us of your full name.
Gloria Rich.
Gloria Rich. Gloria, good to see you.
So I don't know why this comes to mind, but like if you say God developed the world, you know, in 7 days, but now he's making the Hanukkah into 8 days, and there's something like he's extending his power or something like that through the oil.
Good. Feels very Hasidish. Anybody else want to? Bobby?
You know, I guess I'm thinking of Greek temples versus Jewish temples. And I guess this is a very Jewish thing to do, is to do this oil and a kind of an affirmation of our procedure and our way of worship. So the oil and the light is very essential and very different, you know, distinct from the Greek, you know, the Parthenon with Athena in the center, very much based on the god, the image of the god.
Right.
In many ways.
Great. Uniqueness of Jewish worship. No, and in contrast to Avodah Zarah. I mean, we needed all of what you said. I'm just trying to, you know.
No, I like the Jewish
story. We're at Or Zeruah, and we start with "Let there be light." So it's the light is to me the centerpiece of the darkest part of the year. I was under the impression that the reason that they needed the oil to last was because, not that they didn't have plenty of oil, but the actual purification process took 8 days or more. So from the day they regained control until they could actually produce kosher oil is what created the need for this miraculous purity.
Great.
Was there also a message to those Hellenized Jews that could have been the big majority of the country, that a handful of the more Orthodox and the more fun could beat a nation of the Seleucids, and what is pure and what is important could last a lot longer than what it was intended for. So maybe bringing back the whole nation to some sort of more Orthodox Judaism.
Mm-hmm. So the pure, more intent handful of religious could overcome not only the nation,
but their own people.
But preserve their own people.
Right.
David?
When I was a camp counselor, I remember the orientation, the first thing the director said to us was, you never know when you're going to affect the life of a child. And I think similar to what you're saying, but a little bit different, is that when we do something good, and conversely, when we do something bad, we never really know the impact of that. And there's unintended consequences, there's unanticipated consequences, and in this sense, doing something that brings light might extend more than we know.
Great.
We don't know it right away. Sometimes we know it a few years later.
Right. Okay.
Let me react to a number of wonderful, beautiful ideas you've said already, and then we're going to look at some sources and see where they also help us see some of what's been said at the table. But just with this purity notion and linking, Barry, to what you're saying about the process of the 8 days being towards producing more pure oil, that the pure oil burns 8 days according to one Midrashic source, because it is so pure that they were in a state of Tuma and they didn't need it to be Tahor. Somehow the story, though, is about it being pure, and at a certain point you have to go back, Aryeh touching on what you're talking about, to the purest way of doing it. And the purest way in this sense, I'll just make the mention here very explicitly, is the Kohanic way, is the temple way, despite the rabbinic culture who's now come to actually create the holiday and to give you the option, a very different option, in terms of kindling any light, right? They're not talking about rebuilding a temple. We've rejected that idea, as a matter of fact, pretty explicitly. Yet, there's this depth of bringing forward the purity of temple culture. And the fact is that another of the Midrashim is very explicit about their needing 8 days, not to connect to this, what I said, it's Hasidisha, because a lot of the Hasidic homily that comes about 8 days in terms of Hanukkah, in terms of a bris, is that there's just one more than creation, and that there's a different dimension to that reality. And so many, many different ways of saying that within Hasidic drush material from definitely the 18th century in through the 19th century particularly, and then 20th century, the Shlomo Rebbe really picks up on that. But you need this to get back to some purity within the temple. There's also somewhat, and this is not borne out in the sources, but it could be part of what's going on underneath in a rabbinic way, and it could be, in this sense, somewhat critical of Kohenic culture, that there needs to be some reattainment of true purity in temple business if the temple is going to survive from when the Hashmonaim retake it. It could have been somewhat of a critique about why it is toppled soon after that, if they can't keep it as pure as that one cruse of oil really is, then we'll need to make Hanukkah. Then we'll need to remember the history and not enact the kind of lighting on the southern wall with the temple menorah. Right? We'll need to have quite a different approach when it comes to pure oil. And when it comes to the central place in Torah that they, or many, describe as the place that hints us into the fact that Hanukkah will come about through a Torah clue, which we've called in the Gemara an asmachta, right? An asmachta. An asmachta is that hook I need to hang my hat on when I say, I have a verse that definitely mentions Hanukkah in the Torah. That's an asmachta. And I have such a verse, and that verse contains the words Shemen Zait Zach, pure, pure oil. And that the oil is the central feature of a unique Jewish worship. Moving into the notion that we highlight the defeat of the Greek culture, and the oil being an everlasting Judaism or Jewish people, a survival of the Jewish people, for sure, we know a lot about the rabbinic focus on that piece because of Ala Nisim, the prayer that we insert in Modim. Ala Milchamot, Ala Teshuot, the fact that we have the books of Maccabees preserved in their own way in the divine plan. We didn't create a group of books of Maccabees within our own Tanakh and within our own canon. but for sure they are preserved. And we know that the battles become the greatness, the great miracle in the liturgy, even if they're not really highlighted in the Gemara we're about to see. And so one, in terms of a Jewish literacy, has to hold within one's mindset, as we read the Gemara, the fact that there's another text that is co-canonical going on, and it's preserved in Sidur Rav Amram Gaon, which is the earliest, basically the earliest Sidur that we have. So we know it's a very early text. It's a kadum. It's a tefillah kedumah. And when I say it's canonical, last week I introduced this idea, and I'm more and more convinced every year, that the canon, as we call it, is not simply that we canonize the Tanakh. The canon is the Tanakh and the Mishnah and our prayer book, our liturgy that's being determined as a nusach, as having a form and a shape, and words that are true to form. And all three of those, in my mind, are the canon. You can't have one without the other, despite orality being more central to the Torah Sheba'al Peh. Now that's a little bit the same and a little bit different than Dr. Ben Summer, who was my friend and the Bible scholar from the seminary, who was here to talk about both Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, and the oral Torah being all reactions to the concept of revelation. What I'm talking about is that there's an ongoing process of canonization within the argumentation of the time, including verses from these books that will become the 24, the Tanakh, these books that will become Mishnah Gemara, Tosefta as well, all the Braitas, and the liturgy, which Ben didn't deal with. And we just had a wonderful talk at Camp Ramon, the Berkshires, on the deck overlooking the lake, and the moon was out. It was fantastic. I said, well, Ben, what do you think? The liturgy itself could really be part of the canon. There was a deep, deep sense that the Amida, at least, some of the earliest tefillot we have, are really coined and canonized at that time. And we have some of that recorded within Brachot, in the Gemara, but we also have this kind of experience, the lived experience of tefillah, within early synagogue culture, in which we know synagogues are even earlier than we ever imagined. So we're in this discussion and debate. Why I point that out is because there could be either the total support and celebration of temple culture in the various mesechta we've been looking at, which we've been talking about all the yuntas and how we have musaf that celebrates temple culture and how we have customs that come out of temple and lighting in the menorah in the temple and lighting a menorah for Hanukkah. It seems to all make sense that one is kind of giving way to the other in a positive note. It's a continuity factor, a la everlasting Judaism. But here I'm seeing a little bit of criticism as well, that maybe the rabbis are saying, we needed that purity. Yes, the festival was, according to this, 8 days, because we needed to get to that time of purity. And internally, we needed to see that they would keep a world of temple purity going, a purity of worship at the very least, in order for the temple to have sustained the Jewish people. And now that we don't have that, we'll need to create this Hanukkah. It's a rewrite of a Hanukkah that's celebrated probably still at the time of the Chashmonaim, to celebrate the rededication of the temple itself. Barry?
The two other associations that come to mind. One is the eternal light, which is obviously goes back
right
to the temple. And the other, because it is in the Torah, is the anointing oil.
Right.
And the special recipe for making the anointing oil, which obviously relates to the high priest. And so I think the oil definitely brings you back to temple in one way or another, or in multiple ways, not just in one.
No doubt. And if you want to even take it one step further, by way of the anointing and this kind of connection, again, Midrashic literature through the Middle Ages bears this out. People will start to talk about, wait a minute, It's not just the milchamot, it's not just the battles and the war that have a component of the real, real determination of soldiers for Am Yisrael. As a matter of fact, the soldiers of Am Yisrael we also needed were the religious soldiers of Am Yisrael, who are the Kohanim, who were uniquely appointed because of their Kohanic status, who needed to search through the entire rubble. Here's your search and rescue team, right? We always say, first responders, we love you. They go to the rubble. They go through and do the search and rescue, imagining that they're really trying to keep alive everybody who's among the Jewish people, and they really are very attentive towards the human need and not just the ritual items and the rocks. That's not where we're going with this, right? But they go back, they go in, and they recover this one cruse of oil. And that takes some real effort. Ye of little faith could have just said, it's in ruins. We'll never rebuild this. We'll never rebuild this culture. We'll never find a cruse of oil with the Kohen Gadol seal. But they did it. And there's a part in that human beings, from our side, we need to do. So it wasn't just God who saves us. We're not relying on a miracle like that. We're relying on God who provides us miracles, but we also had a part. So that the only part of this is the war and the battle? No. The part of this is the spiritual battle that we had to also undertake, and of little faith to great faith, a la David, you know, this one little bit of light, you never know. It's going to spark the whole Jewish world to come back, whether it's to what we call orthodoxy, which is a very late word in our sociology, but we'll call it, if you will, traditional Judaism, keeping the culture, beating back the Greek assimilationist tides that were part of the tyranny. And the Rambam will go on to say, just in that vein, kitzat min haor, very, very small amount of light, migaresh harbe min hachoshech, dispels an entirety of darkness. And that's why when someone asked me today, if I'm on the 45th floor of a building and there's no neighbors in front of me and I'm the one, like, you know, all the way across the park, or do I still have to put it in my window? And I said, for sure. One small little light, you're going to see it aglow. You're going to see it aglow. Okay. Let's...
Quick question. You had mentioned something before about maybe the purity of the oil being admonished. Warning those going forward in terms of the Kohanim, in terms of how the priesthood is conducted. Is there an odor of vinegar trope that places some blame on corruption within the priesthood for the expansion of Hellenism within the community? Any events? So is there an implicit maybe criticism of what had happened? We want to read into it in terms of the...
I think if you want to trace the inherent criticism of Hellenizer priests, it definitely can happen. You can definitely focus on what happens post the Hashmonai victory, especially, right? But even before that, some question about whether or not the Pharisees and the Sadducees have differences of opinion, the priests and the early proto-rabbinates, top leaders, and then the rabbinites themselves. So yeah, you could trace that. But there's also this other sense of deep respect that I've been positing, right? And that really comes through that we maintain real respect for Avoda of the Beit HaMikdash, of the Kohen's position, of even primacy of Kohenic hopes for all of us, or hopes that a Kohen would be able to once again makriv korban kira'ui, right? And that liturgy even takes that so seriously, right? So it's not just that we think that's the downfall, though certain priests...
Well, exactly.
We're really, really guilty. Okay. This is a Hebrew set of sources. Okay, that's a Hebrew package of sources in front of you. Now it's coming around English.
What a relief.
Okay, I've tried to set it up so that I can direct you and we can toggle back and forth between the Ivrit And the English, at least for the Gemara pages, I do have some more in the Hebrew that I want to just read out loud and translate, and I provided them for people who want to just follow along in the text. And, you know, in the Gemara they say shinana, like when you have to crack your teeth on something, so I apologize in advance if anybody cracks their teeth too hard when it comes to the Hebrew text, but you can sit and listen, or you can follow along. Some of the texts I'll read to you are, you know, for those who have a little Hebrew background, you can hear a word or two. Those who want to really be in it, this is the way I started tracking Hebrew texts without English translations to really challenge myself, to really learn more by way of translation. So I encourage that. But what I did is, as I said, I picked out some places in the Gemara that talk to Hanukkah and that have connections to some of these themes that we just started exploring. And when you feel like there's a connection to anything that we've mentioned thus far, anybody in the class and anything that I've mentioned, after we get through a passage, ready for your comments again, and ready for your comments about, you know, if it brings up a different angle or a different issue. But I thought I'd show you at first on this Talmud Vilna 1 at the bottom, if you're in the Vilna Shas in the Hebrew packet, or 21b4 in front of you. It says Vilna 1 at the top. Was there an extra English package? Yeah, maybe I should take one of those to make sure that I'm... Perfect. Okay. So it says Vilna 1 at the top, and there's an arrow, right? The Gemara reveals the origin of the holiday of Hanukkah. So this is the first place in the Gemara that reveals where Hanukkah, what Hanukkah is. So my Hanukkah, what's the reason behind the rabbinic yontif of Hanukkah? Our school gives us the idiomatic, adds that word rabbinic, because the Gemara is saying, oh, we could be a little surprised here. We have a full holiday, full-out holiday, that's rabbinic. You know, all our other holidays, Parshat Emor, the Parsha in Devarim in Deuteronomy, we have a list of holidays. Hanukkah is not on that list. My Hanukkah, on what account do we celebrate Hanukkah? What's with Hanukkah? Ditanu Rabbanan, we have a bright already, a very early text, time of the Mishnah maybe before it, time of the Tosefta. And it's also found in Megillat Ta'anit, and that's the Ta'anit that we're in, except it's not Masechet Ta'anit. It's an actual scroll of Ta'anit that we're going to discuss when our Masechet Ta'anit brings up that there is a Megillat Ta'anit. That Megillat Ta'anit talks about all the days when Jewish people fast in the ancient world. And on those days, we get some laws about what you can and can't do. And that's going to become part of this discussion in just a second. Bechav he bechislev, yom am de Chanukah. On the 25th day of Kislev, Hanukkah commences. Tamanaya inun, there are 8 days in all. Delo lemispad bahon, and this is what it's saying in the Megillah of Tani, in the scroll of the fasts. Delo lemispad bahon, udelo lehit anot bahon. You don't eulogize on those days, nor may you fast on those days. So it's true. If you have a funeral during that time, the concept is, or like any day that you don't say tachanun, and especially days you say hallel, you would not say a full-out eulogy. In very, very traditional circles, that's taken very literally. There is no eulogy on a day of Hanukkah if there's a funeral. So you would not have an option in most traditional communities to go to the, let's say, Plaza Chapel or Riverside Chapel first. You wouldn't do a chapel service. You would go and you would do graveside, because everything you need to do is graveside. Even for a gadol in some communities, a great, great person. Now, other communities have a little bit of a different twist. And this is generally the mode in New York by traditional conservative, let's say modern Orthodox, and many mainstream Orthodox, that instead of starting with someone's name and we're friends, we're gathered to say our final farewells to so-and-so, It was a loving hmm, a loving hmm, and a loving hmm. If you pay close attention, on a day like Hanukkah, you would hear someone start with, in the Gemara, on Daf 21, it asks, what is the root of Hanukkah? Just as we ask about what really are the values and roots of our beloved so-and-so. So that the little chop is that you start with learning. And you can learn aloud and in someone's honor, as opposed to building a standard eulogy. But it's a very accepted practice, and it would not be as quick as I was quick to get to the, as we learn about so-and-so's life. It would be an explication, a Devar Torah, a little bit of a learning in terms of Talmud. And when I first arrived here, I love these. These are the kind of conversations that, you know, among things, an hour and a half, 2 hours, Rabbi Wechsler and I could sit and schmooze about the shul and shul life, New York life, all kinds of wonderful things to know. And he said, just be mindful. Some traditional families, that or Zeruah, and of course, if you're involved in any of the neighborly doings together with our colleagues at KJ or Chaim, that on days we don't say Tachanun, and especially during those days we could still have a funeral, but it's min yuntiv. In other words, Hanukkah is a little bit of a celebration, right? It's not entirely a yuntiv. We still do work. We still do a burial. We go to a shiva house. We still light a Hanukkah menorah. But you might have to change your approach to the way that we speak at a funeral. Yeah, so this is real. It still happens today. It's still very much in play. Megillat Tani included these days of Hanukkah. Hanukkah becomes a well-accepted rabbinic holiday already by this time. It's sitting right here on page 21 in Masechet Shabbat, right? Which we said when we learned Masechet Shabbat. Very important Masechta, not only for the Shabbat laws, but the fact that all of rabbinic culture, right, centered on creating this Sabbath reality.
My son bought me a new thing for Hanukkah, and but I don't know how to work it. It's terrible. I'm sorry.
You're tied in. Since it's dinging, I will just make the connection. We talked about Hasidic stuff before. Yeah. The Noam Elimelech, who's a Hasidic Rebbe, in the text, there are these little asterisks when the book got printed, right? And in between the Torahs, we call them the Hasidic Torah, there are these little asterisks, right? So those little asterisks, some people say, were like a hit on the gong between these Far Eastern gurus' teachings that they used to hit. Gong. Yeah. So that to me was like the gong. That to me was like the gong. Anyhow, the rabbinic Masechta of Shabbat includes this question about a rabbinic holiday now that is accepted, and we don't eulogize, we don't fast. And now we get to the historical reality. When the Syrian Greeks entered the sanctuary, heichal being the word for that inner sanctuary, right? The heichal. Timu kol ashmanim shebeheichal. They contaminated all the flasks of oil that are in the heichal, in the temple. Ukeshegavra malchut beit chashmonai v'nitzchum. And when the royal Hasmonean house gained the upper hand and vanquished them, Badku, they went out and they checked and they uncovered and they searched through the rubble and they turned every stone and they went and they searched, right? You could imagine they're looking for one pach, one cruse that's got the seal of the Kohen Gadol. Velo matzu ela pach echad shel shemen. They only found one cruse of oil. Shehaya munach v'chotamo shel Kohen Gadol. That was lying there with the signature or seal still intact of the Kohen Gadol. Lo haya bo ela lahadlik yom echad. It contained only enough oil for one day. Nasa vo nes. But a miracle was performed. Vehidliku mimenu shmona yamin. and they kindled the lights of the menorah with it for 8 days. Mind you, hidliku mimenu, shmona yamin. They lit the menorah for 8 days. L'shana acheret kiva'um v'asa'um yamim tovim. And they recognized the miracles, and at a later time, they established and rendered these 8 days yamim tovim, festival, some type of festival days. Now you would imagine that Yom Tov was already a concept. So as soon as they said that, the Jewish literacy bells go off. Oh, Yontif. 8 days of Yontif? Wait a minute. It's not Yontif. Well, it's like Yontif. Wait, is it like Chol HaMoed? Wait a minute. What do I mean by Yamim Tovim? And I have to figure out in my Jewish literacy mind, what does that really mean? Bahalel v'hoda'ah. And here's how they were like Yontifs. You said Hallel on that day, which is the prayer or the set of Psalms that we know as a prayer, if you will, or the prayer package that goes along with a fantastic day on the calendar, which we know they said both in Eretz Yisrael and in Babylonia for Rosh Chodesh. And we know that they said it for Sukkot, and we know that they said it for Pesach. And each day, we take from this word Bahalel, that it's a full Hallel, and not like a Rosh Chodesh experience of saying parts of Psalms, V'hoda'ah, and thanks, or gratitude. And that's also a key word, like we said, Hazkara was a key word for mentioning God's powers in the second bracha of the Amidah, and we said Bakasha, or She'ela, request for rain, was in that ninth blessing. The request, hoda'ah, is a code word in liturgical terms for adding a prayer liturgy of thanks within the 18th blessing of the Amidah to recognize the great miracle that happened. What's the irony of the fact that the hoda'ah of Hanukkah is mentioned while we're talking about the great ness, the great miracle of the candle, of the oil, of the hadlakah, of the burning of the menorah for 8 days? Greatest irony in the world. That the liturgy of thanks within Modim in the 18th blessing of the Amidah does not contain a single reference to the miracle of 8 days of hadlakat Hashemet. It does mention that they kindle the lights. Hidliku et ha-nerut ha-lalu, or ha-elu, depending on which sidur you have. But it doesn't necessarily say the total miracle that from one cruse of oil came enough for 8 days of kindling.
This being in the Shabbos chapter, it being 8 days means that it has to include one Shabbos.
Correct. Correct. And so we're going to fold in a most important day in our culture, right, into this rabbinic holiday, so that we're celebrating not only the temple, a great point that we'll see come through in many other of the traditions that they're going to unpack for this holiday, right? We're not only going to celebrate the culture of the temple, we're celebrating Shabbos too. Yeah, Ron, then Diane, then Jay, then Dale.
So the welting oil, if you have good, many jars of good oil, very pure, what was the purpose of the grate to degrade it? I mean, if you have something that is expensive and pure, what was the...
Oh, so it was worth nothing to them, about Bobby's point, that to them, they didn't need oil for anything. They don't anoint with it. They don't use it in kindling anything. They don't need...
No.
But
they
not Kohenic oil.
Like the candle,
not Kohenic oil. They're not using Jewish temple oil. So they are dissociating themselves from this Jewish worship and dissociating us from all our ritual accoutrements.
So why they need to let them out? I don't understand.
Because they just wanted to defile the very
heichal.
They wanted to defile the whole place. It was vandalism. Ron, let me push it even further. We don't have the term yet defined. It was vandalism It was Greek vandalism.
They destroyed the place and it was contaminated with cement or whatever. That I understand.
No. But you have to include this as well. This is Greek vandalism of Jewish culture.
We were always taught that they slaughtered pigs, and is that just a made up story? I mean, wasn't so important to focus on that I just examined the historicity of it. But that was certainly part of what.
They did bring treif animals, yes, according to legend into the, we don't know from their codes, but treif animals to treif avodah zarah idols and the like. Who do I say next? Diane.
So has there ever been a discussion of what I see as the same root in Hashmonim and the Shemin?
Oh, of course there has been, right? So there's what to notice in here, that maybe they were known as the expert oil family, that family that could identify it. And we're given a clue as to why this family of Kohanim uniquely was in power and in the right place at the right time. And not only that, but if they were anointed in a certain way themselves as those who would become captain of the military guard, right? Because here we thought the Kohanim were supposed to be spiritual leaders,
right,
and they were expert shemen makers, but what? They're also now the true leaders of the military might of the people. Then we see how the temple culture that is oftentimes associated with Rabbi Akiva, and mind you, we had Rabbi Hammer here who called some question into that history, whether Rabbi Akiva was really the revolutionary rebel who wanted to again fight Rome militarily or not. So he threw some question mark into that in his latest book about Rabbi Akiva. But you hear about the military connection to Kohenic discipline, if you will, and that we need them to be both the military leaders, and when we talk about the military leaders, then what are we really talking about? Also the spiritual leadership of these Kohanim, who could potentially restore pure worship, or the rabbis could be asking, are they going to be able to hold true to this? Right? And that's, again, some of the questions that are here. Nice, but it's a nice connection, right? And it's a different understanding of who these people were in terms of the story.
The Mogin that we say during the repetition that does specifically refer to the temple, when is that dated with respect to the Modim that's the 18th blessing in and of itself?
So the Modim and the blessing that we say in and of itself, there's debate about just how early any true form and substance of the Amida itself really is. So we have mention of the fact that there seemed to be an inherited group of 18 blessings and that they were brought to the rabbis already who were sitting in their collective work doing the editing of the Mishnah, and that somehow they were from Yumei Mordechai. They were from Mordechai's time, back in the diaspora. Was that fanciful? Who knows? Because oral culture goes back a long way. The fact that Rav Amram Gaon has a full version of Alanisim and the Hoda'ah, and that the Gemara mentions Hoda'ah, and that's a clue into our world of prayer, meaning it happens in Modim, has to mean that it's centuries old already by the time he writes it in such fullness, and we continue to this day to say it. So you're talking about it being definitely rabbinic age liturgy.
Right, but the fact that, I mean, not many of the prayers have an alternate version that's the only one, isn't it? That has an alternate version that's...
You mean Purim and Hanukkah having two different ones?
No, I mean the fact that there's a Modim that's in repetition.
I'm sorry, I was not focused on the Modim Darabanan that you're talking about.
Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot what to call it.
You're right.
The Modim Darabanan, that it does include a specific... You mentioned before the Modim doesn't mention the light or the oil or by inference the Beit HaMikdash. I'm saying the Modim Darabanan does mention...
Okay, so let me make distinctions here. The Modim that I'm talking about is the Alanisim Be'ala Horkan about Hanukkah, which is the insert. And that insert goes through the battles that we fought and
right,
that the few delivered the Jewish people out of the hands of the great many who were going to forcibly convert us and wipe us off the face of the earth spiritually. Okay, so that's what I meant by that one. It doesn't mention the particular 8-day miracle of the cruse of oil.
Right.
though it does mention they lit lights. The modim de Rabbanan that Jay's talking about is, remember when we have a repetition of the modim prayer, that there's a small paragraph, smaller print in the Siddur Sim Shalom we use, smaller print in Korin, and that is mentioned already in Brachot as the result of a committee who couldn't decide on which line. And they put into place four or five sentences of gratitude that people would say during a repetition of an Amida to gather their gratitude and express their thanks, which I think is a fantastic element of our liturgy, by the way. It's just an amazing moment of saying, you know what? They're all good. Put them all in there. By the way, when we make a repetition of Modim during a repetition of the Amida, it also creates a cultural sound of the leaders trying to say one thing, the Jews in the pews are saying their own thing, and everybody's talking over each other, and actually you're supposed to say it out loud and not just be quiet when you're making the repetition. Rabbi Lookstein will tell you, if you're leading services over by his bima, no, fully out loud. Because his father used to say, fully out loud, Modim. And you say these two in conjunction, it sounds like a Beit Midrash. It's a Beit Midrash of gratitude. It's beautiful. Dale, you.
Is the Brayta just the first sentence, or is it the whole story?
This Brayta so far is basically the whole story in this Masechet. Okay? You're going to have more to the story, if you will, within the dialogue, but it's more going to be about halachic ramifications, what we do about whether or not someone puts a candle out in front of their business and it falls over and it's in the public thoroughfare and I'm allowed to sue and I can get a lawyer. Is the city responsible? Is the store owner responsible? Or is no one responsible? That's immediately the next discussion, right? Very rabbinic. Who's responsible here? And the reason they do that is because if the store owner thought he would be responsible if he placed his menorah outside his door, his Hanukkah lamp outside his door, and it was yay high, and a guy comes by with a camel and he knocks it over, and there's damage to all the merchandise, and there's a wind, and if we say he's responsible, he might not respect the rabbinic legislation that we've put into place. And that is, not only do we have to have people light candles, but we have a second mitzvah, not just the hadlaka, we have the mitzvah of hanacha, that is placing the menorah in its right spot outside your door.
In Israel, they have them built into the
In Israel, if you walk through the old city on any night of Hanukkah, whether it's the first night, and it's a little light dispelling a lot of darkness, or it's the eighth night, they have these wonderful built into the wall glass boxes. Or some people have, and you can buy these all over in Judaica stores. If you ever thought, like, is that just the case that it comes in when you buy this beautiful Hanukkah menorah? That's not just the case it comes in. It's not like a lunchbox that you get as a bonus when you buy the Hanukkah menorah. It's actually the case you're to use to put outside your door so that you can do the mitzvah of Pirsumid Denisa, of publicizing the miracle. And whether it's Jerusalem or it's all other kinds of places, wow, is it gorgeous. It's gorgeous. If you're a kind of person who, let's just say, we can glean from everybody in every culture, right? As long as they're peaceful to us and let us do our thing. You know, there are beautiful, beautiful parts of having lights all around us in the darkest time of year, right? Beautiful. But if you go to Israel, Ezra and Rabbi Wexler and I were just talking about this over a meal. You go there and you walk around on the eighth night of Hanukkah and your heart is just on fire. Our lights, and it's Israel, and it's beautiful, and it's burning, and it's everyone, because let's say it now, Hanukkah has become uber important in our culture. I'm all for it, by the way. I am all for it. It is not a Hallmark thing. It's not a competition with Christmas thing. I am all for it. What a beautiful holiday.
It's really great to walk around our neighborhood. How many businesses have a Hanukkah in the window?
And today, earlier today, I was coming here and I was on Lexington Avenue, and the Apple Bank has hung the other window, and only two of the bulbs had been turned, and I knocked on the window, and I had the woman sitting at a desk. I walked by earlier and she had turned it, so hopefully tomorrow morning they'll turn the fourth one.
Yeah. Oh, thank God you felt safe doing that.
Yeah.
Honestly,
yeah.
Thank God. What a great New York story. What a great New York story. You knock on the bank, you tell them which day of Hanukkah, they're happy to oblige, not only to oblige, but to celebrate.
I didn't even ask what account.
Are you an account holder?
She was in her window by her desk.
I'll tell you one more. Today I went, I spent some time with Nanette Lukashuk, who sends hellos. And I walk into the building, and they have the sweetest note from the doorman to the Jewish residents. Not just a happy Hanukkah. We, the staff, wish each of our residents who's celebrating the holiday a happy Hanukkah and brightness. I felt, you know, it was beautiful. It was really wonderful. It was really wonderful. Okay, so anybody else have anything before we go on to the next piece?
I just want to say one thing as a continuation of what Diane said. So I just, very vividly when my grandsons were little and we would walk around the city, I was very conscious of all the magnificent Christmas decorations, and there were many menorahs, you know, Hanukkiot, that we could point to and they could point to, and this has changed, you know, the city's picture has changed over the years in terms of the number, and with a little child it's really very important, and it really helps a lot to be able to point to.
Yeah.
To them, and for them to feel that's mine, you know.
Absolutely.
Even on GMA, they do have a Christmas tree, but there's a big menorah there.
Yeah, well, look, we bought ours that's sitting in the second floor lobby right from Chabad.
It's their style.
No, we bought it directly from them.
I know. They make a certain style.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. All right. Let me just let me tell you what the Maharal says about this little part of the Gemara before we go on. If you'd like to follow in the Hebrew, I'm going to be reading from the third page of the Hebrew packet. I'm sorry, I did not get it fully translated, and there's not a translation prepared for the Maharal. There's the small Masechet Shabbat quoted at the top, and then there is text below it. K'she'nichnesu yivanim l'heichal. When the Greeks came in to destroy the temple and they went into the inner sanctuary. Itema, if you're going to say v'chi bishvil shenasa lahem nes v'hadlaka v'lo hayaze rak la'asot mitzvah adlaka hayu kovim Chanukah? So he asks the question like this. Wait a minute. You're saying that they had a mitzvah to go light the candles and they went in and they lit the candles? And now we're going to have a holiday for it. It's a mitzvah. What gives? V'chone shechayav lehodot lehalel hu bishvil hatzalato v'lo bishvil shenasa lo neis la'asod a mitzvah. And should we say that every time there's going to be a potential to create a holiday, it's just the same that it's for God's salvation and that somebody did a mitzvah? We should have a holiday? This is what you're made for. The Yesh Lomar, She'ikar ma shekavu yimei Chanukah, I skipped to the brackets. The Yesh Lomar, and one can answer the following. She'ikar ma shekavu yimei Chanukah bishvil ma shenitzchu et ha'yivanim, rak shelo haya nire shehaya nitzachon al yedei neis Hashem yidbarach she'asa zeh. Below me, kocham gvuratam. Well, the fichach nasa anes al yad meirot amenorah. She yedu sheakol hayab anes amilchama gam ken. So one could say the following: that you might have thought God had nothing to do with the battle you fought. You were ready to go out and fight the fight, right? And you might have not attributed it to God at all. And he goes on later and says, you would have quoted Deuteronomy. It says, just by the power of my own hands and my own might. But no, God created not only the great salvation, but also this possibility that out of such a small amount of oil, the light would come and there would be 8 days of kindling, and that we can recognize God's presence within the miraculous days of Hanukkah, and therefore there should be a holiday, is how it's all going to sum up. Davka nes zeh nasa ki ikar rishat ha-yivanim shetimu et ha-hecha. The essence of the miracle is to understand that it had everything to do with the wickedness of the Greeks. Uchamo she'amru she'nichnasu yivanim le-hecha. That they were able to actually do this, and that there could be a power in the world, in other words, that could overcome the greatest evil that the world knew. Ritzonam lomar shehem timu et ha-hechal. That is, that they wanted to really impurify, vandalize even. Timu being used here in that sense of a lemkin, vandalization. The beginnings of spiritual and maybe even physical genocide. V'chein amru b'chol makom, avne mizbeach sheshiksu an sheyavan v'chein b'chama mekomot. And this is the whole issue that the question arose whether or not there could be miraculously a way to purify what had become impure before. And in fact, that is going to happen. Hashem Yibarach Ra'av Astah Shetimu Heichal Shelo. They, in fact, were said to have made it impure. V'natan Koach B'yad Choshmonai. And those priests who had the power given to them to use sanctification oil, Shehem Kohanim Ovdei Hashem Behechalo, that they could truly bring God's presence and worship God back in the center of the temple, Ve'elu Nitzchum Davka V'lo Acherim. And they, Davka, were the ones who were given that power because they could be the ones to bring back purity inside the precincts of Kodesh Baruch Hu, inside the precincts of the one God, as we said before. Hit that one God symbol. L'fichach Kasher Nitzchum Tiaru Et Amikdash. And when they won, and when they had, in their victory, they brought back the purity of the temple and its precincts. So, Chamoshe tiknu ba'al anisim, v'achar kach ba'u v'anecha livir beitecha v'tiaru et mitashecha. And that is what we say in the liturgy, in the Modim prayer, that they returned and they purified the temple. That was a miracle, in other words. That was a miracle. Okay, so let's leave that for now, because I want to get to other Gemaras and other parts of the story.
I want to make a point.
Yeah.
I just noticed a language thing that I realized I was missing all my life.
I love these moments.
The word itself, Hanukkah.
Yeah.
Because it says here, on this page, Midrashay Hanukkah here.
Which page?
Hey Dalet,
okay.
Under the Lefichach.
Okay.
It says, Kasher lo haya lahem shemen nasa lahem nes, kidei shiklu letayu, ulechanech habayit. Ulechach nikra Chanukah shayu mechanchim. The verb lachnoch in Hebrew, I never made a connection with the word Chanukah.
That's the root of the
word. Lachnoch, I know. But we use the word lachnoch in a different way, not as a name of a holiday. It's a verb that's used. Lachnoch bayit, the beginning of something.
Sure.
New. But I just realized
that
I never...
Yeah, and he makes it explicit.
So what is the verb?
It's used here as a verb.
Tell Bobby how you would translate it.
Yeah, how would you translate it?
Lachnoch means when you, like inaugurate. It's an inauguration, well, with lachnoch.
We have but some
it's
special
also, but
to
it's
cut
also,
the ribbon.
It also appears among youth, you know, the chonchim, you know that because you work with youth. People who are in charge or like being mentors or teachers or instructors, you're a chonech. Lachnoch young people, but I don't see the connection there.
Well, I'll tell you in a second how the sources make the connection.
Like an initiation or something.
A dedication.
Dedication. Right.
This notion of dedication of the house, the Chanukat HaBayit, when we hang up a mezuzah, is called the Chanukat HaBayit.
Right.
This notion of reclaiming the temple and purifying it, Chanukah Habayit. Yes, you've made the connection. That is the connection that the Maharsha wants us to make if we've not before. If we have before, because Chanukah has that same, L'chanech, what is it then that's at the core of the Kohanim's job? And you can already see this in Sifrut HaNavi. We have a Haftarah for Pesach that points out, what is the job of the Kohen beyond lighting the lights, beyond bringing Korbanot? Job of the Kohen Gadol, job of the Kohanim themselves, and I would argue that Sefer Ezra makes this most explicit, that their job is to teach our sacred texts. Their job is to teach our sacred law. As much as they were not the Rabbinites, and they didn't interpret like Chazal, they still were those to teach Torah law. And even while the Rabbinites developed their own system of Drush and Halakha and Jewish law and what have you, you get that sense from Chanukat HaBayit that they were L'chanechet HaChanichim. They were educating the students. And every Jew who's a Talmid Chacham, who's a pupil of the sages, could be called a Chanich every time he comes to the Beit HaMikdash. Not just a Makriv Korban, not just someone who offers a sacrifice, but he's being educated in our ways. And whether it's a liturgical passage that the Kohanim had to teach them, the history of, like, let's say when they brought Bikurim, the history of their own people, or it was other laws that must have gone on because of the prophetic literature we have, we know that they were the ones to bring the Torah, to read it aloud. And Ezra, the book of Ezra, when they return to the second temple, after Cyrus allows them back into Jerusalem, right? What does he do? He organizes what I call the first Torah convention. It's like the first limud. If anybody's ever been to one of those great volunteer major, we were just talking about it this week, and Dave and I have been talking about it. Limud is, by the way, a wonderful gathering of pluralistic, very pluralistic in its vision, and it's an enacted Jewish convention of learning of all types and stripes, and there's a Shabbat related, and it's almost like a kinos. In this case, it's going to be very urban, and it's going to be in New York City this coming winter, so people can have it on the radar. It's going to be a great opportunity.
Registration is open. It's going to be Washington, President's Weekend.
President's Weekend.
It'll be at mostly at Rota Shalom, and a Friday night dinner at Roman.
Uh-huh. And there's
reasonably priced.
Various elements and reasonably priced, lots of different learning opportunities. Bottom line, I'm bringing it up because Lahavdil, back in Ezra's time, they create a temple, right? If you read the rededication of the temple, they bring the Torah scroll into the public square and they read it to the Anashim, Nashim, the Tapim. They read it to the men, the women, the small children. And then, if you read the next chapter, which people stop usually at that point and say, look, this is where Torah, public Torah reading came from, and this is the great culture we have of public Torah reading in our synagogues, and it's true, it's wonderful and great to stop there. You could just learn that. But the next part is that Kohanim were assigned, the way I read the text, Kohanim were assigned to bring different groups of people into the precincts in small group format, right? After the big Torah reading. And they were in groups discussing these laws and getting back to the dedicated work of creating Jewish Jerusalem. And that defines Chanukah Habayit. And that is really what Hanukkah could be about. Could be, I say, because again, will we have the temple? Will we maintain and sustain purity of avodah, purity of law as much as purity of oil? Or will we need a new culture? And the rabbis create the new culture. We know. They're not returning us to the temple, but they are remembering the temple. And through Hanukkah, we recall the possibility of purity of worship, the possibility of all that was uniquely Jewish, the possibility of Jewish culture as it must stand now. And the rabbis take us into that culture by talking about then torts And we don't want to make anyone responsible because they won't place their menorah outside if they're really going to be taken to court. So if there's a mistake, we have to give the benefit of the doubt. He wanted to put it there because he was doing the mitzvah that we ordained, just like this traveler has to understand that it's Hanukkah time, and we can't really sue the shop owner because he would stop doing the business of placing the menorah. And if we're going to have mitzvot that we really ordain as true mitzvot, then we're going to also have a blessing. And within the Shabbat tractate, or within the Shabbat passages about Hanukkah, we actually get the form and substance of what will become a very known candle lighting blessing for us for Shabbat, which, by the way, is never mentioned explicitly as a blessing for Shabbat, but is mentioned explicitly as a blessing for your hadlaka, lahadlik ner shel Hanukkah. So that connection, I think, is really there. Last comment before I move us to that
just
page.
Because I think you mentioned that the Maharal you didn't have translated into English, so I want to make sure I understood what he said. Because to me it sounds incredibly radical and very, very modern. He's suggesting that the miracle of the lights almost was created so as not to distract or lead one to believe that the military victory was the miracle, because not to detract from the heroism of the fighters. Am I not reading it correctly? I mean, that's how I understand what he wrote, which I consider a wonderful, but I'll call it modern, very modern thinking. I've never heard it before, sure.
I read it as the opposite, that don't get distracted by the miracle of the oil and miss the miracle of
the victory.
Oh, I didn't read it that way.
Is that what it means?
And that altogether, though, it calls attention to God's place.
So, lest you think it appears that the victory was the result of a miracle. And v'lomi kocham u'glorotam, and not from their strength and their heroism. That's the way I understand it.
Well, it's lest you think that it was only by God and miraculously, and wasn't, if you will, without their strength and their power. Lefichach nasa anes al yedei neirota minora, that the godly miracle in and of itself was the miracle of the oil.
Exactly.
But I'm not sure that it's going all the way to say that it was only mitzidenu, that it was only our side. Because as I mentioned, he will go on to say, but don't get the wrong impression that it was just us.
Okay.
Milchama, by taking up the battle, right? It's not otzim, you know. It's not kochiv otzim yadi. It's not just my strength. So I benefited from three pages later that I didn't get through.
Thank you.
Okay, but at that place you could have had that hava amino. Okay, let's go to, in the English, the next page, which is 23A1. This aligns, you see at the bottom I have Vilna 2. So in the Hebrew packet, if you want to get the Hebrew page, you can turn to Vilna 2. Okay, and I've got underlines there where it starts, Va'od. Yeah? Va'od. Yeah? Okay. Va'od. And now we're going to have another, if you will, proof about kindling lights. Midika mivarchina. Since we bless just before doing the mitzvah, right, over la'asiatan is the halachic principle. I go directly to the action of lighting after I bless. Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu lahadlik ner shel Chanukah. Blessed are you, God, who has sanctified us with his commandments and has commanded us to kindle the Chanukah light. It's obvious that the rabbis who authored the blessing viewed the kindling as an essential mitzvah. Because the discussion before is the kindling an essential mitzvah? Or is the placing of it an essential mitzvah? And if I have a Shabbos light that's burning all of Shabbos, and I go over and I'm going to use that, if you will, for my Hanukkah light, do I have to extinguish it and light it again? Or can I just kind of bless it the same way I bless a Shabbat light? Or just place it. And that's the mitzvah anyway. And really there is no mitzvah of actual lighting a light. But no, here the Gemara says lighting a light is important. It must be important. Why? Because we have a unique and distinct blessing. And by the way, Asher Kiddushanu B'Mitzvotav Tzivanu, who commanded us to actually light the candles as a mitzvah? Well, it's not written explicitly in the Torah, but it's a mitzvah nonetheless. Ah, it really must be Lahadlik is a mitzvah.
So, I went and found Mahalotcha.
Okay.
So, it starts with, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak unto Aaron and say unto him, when thou lightest the lamps, the seven lamps shall give light in front of the candlestick. So, God is commanding that Aaron light the candles.
No, the candelabra on the south side of the Mishkan and thusly the Beit HaMikdash, but not the candles of the Hanukkah menorah.
No, I know that. Well, but
that's not where they learned this mitzvah from. That's not their asmachta.
No.
You might make the good argument. If you're a Rishon, let's say you're a Rishona, you're sitting with the Maharsha, and you say, listen, why don't we use this asmachta? Right? That one is generally seen as the mitzvah for what? Hadlakat ha-menorah. But not hadlakat ha-chanukiyah.
Understood, but wasn't what they were lighting that with that one cruise of oil, that was not...
But now we're not there. Now we're post that time of the temple being destroyed.
Now we are trying to...
Now we're post the temple being destroyed. And the Kohanim are not in discussion any longer. Now we're talking about mitzvot that we consider to be our approach to this Hanukkah festival that is post a destruction moment of our temple being destroyed. And here's how we do it. So yes, if we don't make that shift within the dialogue, we could see that this bracha might have been discussed in the context of lighting the lights, because we know that Aaron had the mitzvah to light the lights, right? But that's not what they're discussing by the time they get to this part of the discussion of Hanukkah on page 23a. And granted, we went from page 21 to 23, and we didn't say explicitly, now we're defining the lighting of the Chanukiah versus the lighting of the menorah in the Heichal. Or in the south wall.
When they went into the temple and they found the cruse of oil, and what they were lighting was a six-branch menorah. So that's what Aaron...
Right, but we don't have, in that sense, in Yom where there, it's mm-hmm. explicit, in some of the other Masechtot that deal with it, we don't have this bracha. We are now describing a post-destruction Hanukkah.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't necessarily come back to this pasuk that you're bringing and say, of course we have a mitzvah d'oraita, meaning a Torah mitzvah, mm-hmm. to light candles. Because that was the age of the Kohanim, and this is now the age of the Rabbinite Judaism that we follow today.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we're discussing here. And the argument that they're in is about a Hanukkah experience post-destruction, about whether or not lighting is a mitzvah, or just placing that menorah outside your door is a mitzvah. And here we get proof that lighting must be a mitzvah to the rabbis, because we have a blessing, Asher Kiddushanu B'Mitzvotav Tzivanu. Thank you for helping us clarify where we are.
Okay.
Barry.
I see the political dimension here, though. So you've got the rabbis, they're no longer a temple, there's no longer a high priest. The whole issue of authority is pretty much complicated and maybe a little bit up for grabs. And so by rooting an absolutely, unequivocally rabbinic holiday, you want to have it reflect enough of the tradition that it's not viewed as alien. So if you're going to start making new holidays, because the it's not in there, now you could say that's chutzpah, right? I mean, so you better be really careful that you're not straying too far out from the tradition if you're going to take on the creation of a brand new holiday.
Spoken like a true administrator. I think you're very right. I think the careful balance is essential. The connection to, and it's that easy to do, by the way. Imagine that we were part of this editorial group who was hearing traditions about my Hanukkah for the first time, and we were in the discussion of the Kohanim, and then someone pipes in, starts a whole new discussion of Asher Kedshanu, and there's this immediate assumption like, of course there's a mitzvah to light candles, because I have a verse. I mean, this was authentic, just now, to the living tradition that could have just come about, right? And the debate would have been, who says it's not a mitzvah? Right? It is a mitzvah. This one's so clearly attached to what seems like something we did in the Mishkan and the temples. Who would debate it? But we know full well that the rabbis are very sensitive to this issue. When we studied chapter 16 of Shabbat, and they were trying to create the afternoon culture of the Sabbath, meaning a 25-hour Sabbath, and they knew people both got back to work and or hung out with their neighbors who went down to the philosophy house and enjoyed a little bit of Greek thought at the local cafe. They said, no, you should come back to shul. You should hear a Torah reading. You should hear a drash. You should learn Jewish sources. You should learn halakha. They were sensitive the way they said it, as not to totally alienate Jews who were somewhat associated with their neighbors. I think it plays out time and again, particularly in Masechet Shabbat, around some of the most essential cultural productivity that they had and wanted to establish, which is why I think, again, Hanukkah is so important to them. Oh, it's 9 o'clock. No. I have such other good, I have good stuff here. I want to share with you that I think what we've been doing for several years here is gaining more of an adult outlook, a Talmid Chacham, a Talmid Shelha Mesoret outlook in the Beit Midrash when it comes to our holidays and festivals, our liturgies, and our prayer experiences. And tonight, I hope you took one more step up, the steps leading to the temple, to think about Hanukkah as a holiday of rededicating our temple, the Hanukkah Rabbi, the placing of that temple in our midst, and the Hanukkah experience as history, as rabbinic legislation, as ways of celebrating that fully include great miraculous stories, but that have really, really deeper dimensions. So thank you for sharing tonight, as you did as well.
Thank you very much.